The following talk was given by Rafe Martin, guiding teacher of the Endless Path Zendo based in Rochester, New York. The talk was recorded on Saturday, June 17, 2023, on the third day of our four-day non-residential session. You can find additional talks and learn more about our lay practice community at endlesspathzendo.org.
We'll continue with reading from the forthcoming book, The Zen Life of Bodhisattvas. And today we will move from Manjushri, patron of the Zendo, to the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, Kanon, also known as Kanji Zai, Kuan Yin, Valokiteshvara, Chen Rezig in Tibet, though it's probably pronounced differently in Tibetan, but that's how it's spelled. So, asked to write something about the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, Hakuin penned, "Even if the rivers and seas all receded and became dry land, her vow to save all sentient beings still would never cease." In other words, even if the world turns upside down and seas become mountains and mountains seas, which has actually happened, even then the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion will not only think of herself and her own needs, but will remain dedicated in all thoughts and all actions to the welfare of all. Three archetypal images may be said to sum up the essence of Zen practice. The first would be the Buddha sitting beneath the Bodhi tree, touching the earth, realizing intimacy with the morning star. Second would be Manjushri, Bodhisattva of wisdom, swinging his sword, riding his lion, carrying the scroll of Prajna wisdom. Third in this triptych would be Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, hearer of all the cries of the world. While Samantabhadra, Bodhisattva of compassionate action, was traditionally paired with Manjushri in China and Japan, these days, especially in the West, Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, has become the more significant partner to Manjushri. Interestingly, Zen master Hakuin created many paintings of Kanon and a number of Manjushri, but few, if any, of Samantabhadra. Perhaps something was already cooking about this, the shift, at least in his mind. The Lotus Sutra's 25th chapter, the major section of which is regularly chanted in Zen monasteries, is dedicated to the saving power of Avalokiteshvara. In this section of the chapter, the Bodhisattva of compassion frees devotees from every imaginable suffering and disaster. Fires, floods, famine, beasts, torture, prisons, droughts, swords, shipwrecks, you name it. And the Bodhisattva has it covered. Supposedly not belong his before his death, Zen master Dogen is said to have walked around his quarters in Kinin, reciting this section of the Lotus Sutra. In the text, I'm including a chanted version. It's rather lengthy, so I'm not going to read that aloud now. In any case, this might be worth keeping in mind, the saving power of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion. Worth keeping in mind when facing stress or danger. At the least, whether we believe it or not, calling on the Bodhisattva at such times can do no harm, and it may help settle or stabilize the mind enough so that we can face our difficulties, whatever they may be, with a greater sense of possibility, intelligence, and skill. Who's to say that that in itself might not be the action of the Bodhisattva of compassion to whom we've petitioned for help? Iconographically, Avalokiteshvara or Kanon appears in a variety of forms. She may be seated at ease beside a stream or river beneath the branches of a willow. He or she may be standing regarding the world and all its beings with a calm and steady gaze. Whether sitting or standing, Kanon may hold a vase or jar filled with healing balm. When the vase is upright, her healing power is held in readiness. With the vase pointed down, she's releasing compassionate power into the world. She may also hold a scroll or appear as a fisherman's wife holding a basket. In India, China and Tibet, as well as occasionally in Japan as well. Avalokiteshvara may also be shown in masculine form. China's Dunhuang carved and painted cave temples, as well as the Lungmen cave grottos and others, contain many such images. In the Hall of 1001 Buddhas, they're actually kanons, in Sanju Sangendo, which is it's said to be the length of an arrow shot. The Sanju Sangendo is a lengthy hall filled with 1001 life-size gilded, you might say androgynous kanons, not female, not masculine, each with a uniquely individual face, like snowflakes. No two are alike. And at the center of these many orderly rows of really perfectly realized kanons, there sits seated, it's 12 foot high, 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, or kanon. Of all the bodhisattvas' many forms, the 1,000-armed is regarded as the most sacred of all. Known in Japan as Senju Kanon, he or she has 11 heads topped with a Buddha head, able to look in all directions, and 1,000 arms with an open wisdom eye in the palm of each hand. The many arms hold ropes, tridents, staffs, bows, arrows, spears, medicine, bells, teacups, swords, lotuses, rosaries, flowers, brushes, cushions, bowls, all things the bodhisattva can skillfully use to stop, convert, tie up, or cut down egotism, as well as to heal and nurture suffering beings. It is a dynamic image, an image of active compassion bursting skillfully forth while remaining centered and at peace. When you look at such a figure, you think, yes, this is what selfless, skillful, limitless compassion must feel like. We have several 1,000-armed bodhisattvas of compassion at Endless Path Zendo, several standing kanons, a scroll of the bodhisattva seated by a stream, and a Tibetan tonka of a four-armed Avalokiteshvara. All are reminders of and encouragements toward the realization of our own awakened, compassionate nature. In 2006, Rose and I accompanied members of the Vermont Zen Center, Toronto Zen Center, and Casa Zen from San Jose, Costa Rica, to China, where we visited noted Zen sites, among them Rinzai's monastery, where I was surprised to see a huge, perhaps 30-foot high, 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara painted in blues, reds, golds, almost Tibetan-looking, standing behind the spot from which Linji would have presented his Take No Prisoner Teishos. We were told that the image was a faithful reproduction of the original destroyed in the Cultural Revolution. It revealed what no books had hinted, that Linji's uniquely ferocious Zen was actually the expression of deepest compassion. "This is your truth," he was saying, "as it is mine and everyone's. You can do it. You can awake to it. Don't dawdle." Compassion is not simply sentiment or even empathy. It is skillful action. Compassion is wisdom, wisdom, compassion. Hence all those open arms and each of those 1,000, open eyes rather. Hence all those open eyes in each of those 1,000 helping hands. According to the Sharangama Sutra, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was a man in the Buddha's time who, by dedicating himself to the practice of attention to hearing, became fully enlightened. When I was practicing with Eitken Roshi, he told me that the essence of the Buddha's teaching lay in this very inquiry: who is hearing? A practice that takes you to the root of it all. Avalokiteshvara, hearer of the cries of the world, becomes the female Kuan Yin in China, Kanon, or Kanzeon, also Kanjizai, the Lord who observes all in Japan, the male Chenrezig in Tibet, and the source of Tara, the savioress, who emerged from a tear shed by the Bodhisattva upon recognition of our world's sorrows and his compassion's most feminine essence. There are times when our world's sorrows will stun us, and there are times when we ourselves will come face to face with our own pettiness and shortcomings. At such times, we may even convince ourselves that Zen is too demanding, too difficult, and that it is beyond us. Take heart. This is not a new problem, and it is not one we face alone. Here's a quote from the Record of Transmitting the Light, Denkoroku, written by Keizan Jokin, one of Dogen's heirs in 13th century Japan. You may think the way of the Buddha patriarchs distinguishes individuals and capacities. We are not up to it. Who among the ancients was not a body born of a mother and father? Who did not have feelings of love and affection, or thoughts of fame and fortune? However, once they practiced Zen, they practiced thoroughly, thereby achieving enlightenment. This is his Teisho for Transmission Case 3 in the Denkoroku. How do we know that but in trying and failing, we are not setting in motion the very things we most need to help us accomplish our goals? As a teenager, I spent many hours in the backyard shooting arrows at a target. At some point, I came to realize that my many misses were all necessary steps toward my eventually hitting the bullseye. Fears of coming up short in Zen practice, of not being smart enough, or strong, or successful enough, all eventually get stripped away. As our practice continues, we come in time to find that we no longer even think of any of it as failing. Instead, we simply learn to do our best and give our all, regardless of outcomes. This attitude spills over into our life as well. To learn to live like this is itself worth a great deal. Zen practice realization won't give way to us because of our looks, our eloquence, our smarts. It doesn't care who we know or what our salary or social standing might be. It is an iron mountain, or as Western fairy tales might put it, a glass hill. We try, we fail, we try again. Through trying, failing, getting back up, and trying again, our practice becomes genuine and we ourselves authentic. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva's own great vow matured through bitter failure, which I find rather hopeful. Here's the essence of that legend. Goes like this, and you can find an earlier version of this in The Hungry Tigress, an earlier book of mine, the revised and expanded edition from 1999. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, hearer of the cries of the world, looked down into the hells and saw them filled with suffering beings. I will liberate all the beings in the lower realms, he vowed. Through countless ages, he labored, descending into hell after hell, emptying hell after hell. After eons of heroic exertion, the Bodhisattva stood up and wiped the diamonds of sweat from his brow. He looked down into the now empty, silent hells and smiled. It was done. All living things had been freed. Here and there, a curling wisp of smoke rose. Now and then, in some vast cavern below, faint echoes sounded as a loose brick toppled from a pile of rubble. But the raging fires had been quenched, and the great iron cauldrons of boiling blood were quiet. Sweet silence flowed through the dark halls. Even the raging demons were gone, the horse-headed, the tiger-headed, the horned and fanged ones. They too, in the end, had been released by the mighty efforts of the compassionate one. Suddenly, there came a wailing scream, and then another. Flames leapt, smoke whirled, blood-filled cauldrons once again bubbled madly. Whips cracked, chains clanged, demons roared. The radiant smile faded from the Bodhisattva's face. In less than an instant, all was exactly as before. The hells were again completely filled. The heart of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara filled with sorrow. His head broke into 11 heads. His arms shattered into 1,000 arms with an open eye of wisdom in each palm. With his 11 heads, the Bodhisattva could now look in every direction to see the sufferings of every being. With 1,000 wisdom-guided arms, he could now reach into any realm to save those in need. Rolling up his 1,000 sleeves, the Bodhisattva once again got to work. So, to gain insight is not necessarily a good thing. To take a longish time is not necessarily a bad one. Sometimes what is quickly won is never deeply felt. Quick successes may fade without us ever developing the inner strength that persistence brings. When Britain stood alone against the rising Nazi tide, Winston Churchill stood in Parliament and announced, "Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. It is the courage to continue that counts. What is courage but compassion in action? Persist and you may find that you yourself have 11 heads and 1,000 hands." So to go on, we'll look at Hands and Eyes of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, which is case 89 of the Blue Cliff Record. It goes like this. Yun Yen, Ungun in Japanese, asked Dao Wu, Dogo in Japanese, "How does the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion use all those many hands and eyes, or eyes and hands?" Dao Wu answered, "It's like a man in the middle of the night reaching or groping behind his head for his pillow." Yun Yen said, "I understand." Dao Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yun Yen said, "The whole body is hand and eye." Dao Wu said, "That's very well expressed, but it is only 8/10 of the answer." Yun Yen said, "How would you say it, elder brother?" Dao Wu said, "Throughout the body are hands and eyes. Throughout the body are hands and eyes." How does the Bodhisattva of Compassion use all their hands and eyes? How many places can she interact with, and how many activities can he engage in at one time? Isn't Zen about being present for this cloud, this person, this ring of the phone? How could multitasking be Zen? What's going on? Compassionate activity is the great Bodhisattva's entire being. Acting without a single self-centered thought for the sake of all is second nature to the Bodhisattva of 1,000 hands, or first nature. But how does the Bodhisattva actualize the great vow? How does the great vow use the Bodhisattva? How does she realize the commitment to save all beings? How can he see clearly when he has eyes all over? How do they use so many eyes? A whale has an eye on each side of its head. How does a whale bring the two visions together as one? A spider has 8 eyes, compounding the problem. But imagine having 22 eyes, 11 heads times two, plus 1,000 more, an eye in the palm of each hand. How do you use all those eyes without confusion? And how do you respond to all that those eyes see? How do you choose which arm to extend? Emails are coming daily requesting the Bodhisattva to sign this petition, attend this rally, donate to this or that campaign. What should she do? She hardly has time to read the inspiring books piled up on her night table. How not to end up paralyzed by too many choices? especially when in his thousand arms are not just pillows, but ropes, hatchets, steering wheels, computers, iPads, cell phones, shovels, swords, incense, fountain pens, crayons, chisels, life preservers, juice boxes, teapots, medicines. How does the Bodhisattva skillfully use all their arms and eyes? How do they fulfill all those varied possibilities and options? The problem with kindness is that it can be separative, dualistic. I will help you. Compassion arises from the ground of I am you. And because I'm not there, it can't become a big deal. Perhaps it's only something we even notice after the fact. What? I actually did that? We may think. Here's an example, it's an analogy really more than an example, but I was once motorcycling along an empty country road when a deer suddenly leapt out right in front of me. Without thought, my hand grabbed the front brake, my foot stomped down on the rear one. In the next instant, the same hand released the brake and rolled on more throttle, keeping me upright so I didn't fall over from the suddenness of that emergency stop. Picking up speed, I rode on, having missed the deer by fractions of an inch. It happened so fast, not a thought of danger even had time to arise. With no thought, there was no fear. My heart never even sped up. My hands reached out as if on their own, and it was done. Looking back, I found something freeing about this, a glimpse, perhaps, of something accessible to us all, but rarely reached, except in emergencies. But what might it be like to live like that? As lay Zen practitioners, we have opportunities every day to interact and extend or lend, not impose, a hand, which means we have opportunities to integrate what we realize in silent Zazen into our lived lives, not in future ones, not in an idealized time when our Zen training is done and our practice matured, but now, just as we are. Without the opportunities and challenges that come from living our practice, Zen can become a kind of high-class game, a matter of how many koans we pass, or how long we sit, or how many sesshin we attend. But for what? Lay practice keeps it real. There can be no evading, no putting it off into some endless idealized future. The eyes in the palms need to open and guide us now as best as they currently can. Wisdom is a matter of insight, not calculation, which doesn't mean we avoid or eschew thought. Sometimes very careful thought is absolutely necessary. Spontaneity is not a matter of closing off thought or purposefully not thinking, but rather of clear seeing. I like Leonard Cohen's line that a scheme is not a vision. That's from Story of Isaac. Scheme is not a vision. But how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use all those hands and eyes? Well, how do we raise a hand, taste a peach, think a thought, search a memory, catch a ball, grab a brake lever? How do we cry when sad and laugh when happy? We are a hand reaching back for a pillow in the night. The eyes see, or the eye sees but does not see itself. The ear hears but does not hear itself. This is our life. Seeing is responding if we don't suppress the activity that arises from clear, unself-centered seeing. A soccer ball rolls towards the street. We put out our foot and stop it before the neighbor's kids run into traffic. Someone in line at the post office drops their wallet. We pick it up and hand it back. Yet how many times might we have balked, thinking, I see that this is important and I'll do it next time. Or it's just not convenient right now. Or fill in the blank yourself. How easy it is to fall back and separate hands and eyes, eyes and hands, returning to this breath, this count of this breath, this koan point, eyes open and hands reach for pens, brushes, ropes, pots, pans, cell phones, petitions, diapers, incense, sitting cushions. Maturing is a lifetime's work. The Bodhisattva accomplishes great deeds, saves suffering beings, prevents agonies as naturally as reaching back for a pillow in the night, and yet they fail again and again. The hells instantly refill. The effort is as foolish as trying to fill a well with snow, a traditional metaphor for the way of the Bodhisattva. You dump endless shovelfuls of snow into the well, and it all melts away. The well never fills. And yet, is reaching back for a pillow in the night any different than tying a child's shoelace, driving to work, buying groceries, answering the phone? Practicing realization, practicing this breath, this count, this koan, the world steps in. An old teacher once asked his attendant, "What is that sound outside?" It was raining at the time. The attendant dutifully answered, "The sound of raindrops." The teacher was hardly convinced, not intimate enough, not by a long shot. How do we express intimacy as life? The great Zhao Chu, when asked, "Why did Bodhidharma come from the West?" a classic way of asking, "What is the highest teaching of the Buddha Dharma?" answered, "The oak tree in the front garden." It had nothing to do with being illogical or stopping conceptual thought. I have heard such views, and they very much miss the point. Nor is it a coded way of saying that Bodhidharma was so compassionate that he came even for the sake of this tree, or that all beings, even this tree, are Buddha. No! Zhao Chu was intimate. But would his oak tree in the front garden have convinced that other old teacher who'd asked about the sound outside? What else might Zhao Chu have done? How do you see it? Attending to each breath, or to each count of each breath, or committing ourselves fully to the question of a koan being our practice, means that we can shift our attention from its habitual unconscious focus on the compulsively self-centered self. And when we do, when we make this simple shift and change channels, 1,000 eyes open. Ours, our eyes, bird's eyes, bug's eyes, the eyes of trees and clouds, attending to the count, the breath, the koan, 1,000 hands flex and reach. We discover that we didn't need to glue those many arms on one by one, like so many merit badges either. Instead, we find the 1,000 hands that are already ours. In the Genjo Koan, actualizing the fundamental point section of the Shobo Genzo, Eye of the Treasury of the True Dharma, Zen Master Dogen lays it out clearly. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, one's own body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. To forget the self is not to suppress or ignore it. Zen practice asks us to explore our deepest assumptions of what and who and where we are. It encourages us to look into such questions as, what is this self? Where is this self? If we keep at it, we may begin to see that our sorrow is that we live in a dream turned nightmare, a comfort zone turned prison, not forgetting the self, but believing ourselves to be utterly separate and alone. We shortchange ourselves and create an isolation that not only harms ourselves, but everyone and everything. This simple error in how we use our minds, attachment, to an habitual fixed belief in a seemingly solid, isolated, permanent ego self underlies such self-destructive activities and behaviors as wars, racism, environmental destruction, misogyny, the whole catastrophe. And so we fail to live intimately, in harmony, with animals, peoples, trees, mountains, rivers. This intimacy is not something simply to be wished for, but is, as ongoing Zen practice can confirm, our real condition, our birthright. Not to see it, even if only momentarily, is the cause of so much sorrow. Tara was born from a tear that fell from the eye of the Bodhisattva of compassion. The first vow of all bodhisattvas is to save the countless beings from the endless sufferings caused by this fundamental delusion of dualistic self-centeredness. Saving in Zen does not require knocking on doors or handing out leaflets. An introductory koan challenges us to save a ghost and demands that we demonstrate our understanding in concrete and specific, not theoretical or philosophical ways. How does saving or freeing take place? How does the Bodhisattva of compassion manage it? How to use all those hands and eyes? Forgetting this self also means that we stop unconsciously putting our own self-centered needs and demands onto everyone and everything else, which literally frees them all from ourselves, releasing birds freely to the air, bugs to the soil, flowers to the spring, as Dogen also says. Freeing ourselves then frees all, which sounds suspiciously narcissistic and overblown, but it comes down to simple things. Counting this breath. Experiencing this breath, questioning completely who is hearing, or becoming absorbed in a single koan point. By practicing with focus and attention, forgetting the self in the count, the breath, the koan, the world just as it is steps in not abstractly, but uniquely and fully. Or rather, this worm on the sidewalk, this falling leaf, this morning star steps in. And because they do, we can step out of our old sad dream of isolation and can begin to live in a truer world. Or if you want, don't forget the self. Don't. Hold on to it as tightly as you can. See if it is solid and as permanent as you believe it to be. Try to find it. Search and search. What do you find? Bird song, pain in knees, itchy nose, endless thoughts, feelings, sensations, sound, sight, taste, touch, smells. Is there anything more? Is there nothing more? Where is myself? Is hands and eyes all there is? How does the Bodhisattva use hands and eyes? Master Dogen turned that around and asked, how do hands and eyes use all those bodhisattvas? When Yunyan said, I understand, or I get it, was he saying, sure, I understand? Or was he saying, aha, now I get it? But what is there to get? If we are whole and complete from the start, as the Buddha proclaimed upon his great enlightenment, wonder of wonders, all beings are Buddha, how much more whole and complete can we become? Yet if we are whole and complete, why don't we know it? And why must we work so hard to wake to it? That question gave young Dogen no peace. But in time, that no peace opened his way to great peace. What is the relation of seeing to doing, insight to action, zazen, to our complex and demanding lives? Is our aim to be calm and quiet, or is that just the beginning of being able to do what? It's like reaching back for a pillow in the night, says Dao Wu. That sounds easy enough, but is it? And what is meant by night? What is the darkness? Is it a simple antithesis of daylight? Is this night a bad thing? And doesn't real seeing and doing demand full attention? How can a sleepy, half awake, half asleep condition, neither one nor the other, be of any use? Further, what about those two answers? Hands and eyes all over the body, hands and eyes throughout the body. Which one's better? Is one more accurate, more true? Is there a point being made here? Or are these two old worthies just being clever? And if that's it, if that's all that's going on, why should we even care? And what about those 8/10? Is 80% good enough? What about 100%? Is this simply another failure? Zen Master Dogen, commenting on this koan, said that if real criticism were implied, Dao Wu wouldn't have said, "You answer well, but it's 8/10. Instead, he'd have said, "That's 8/10, or that's 80%. Why is that? What's Dogen getting at? If we're not lost, drifting aimlessly in our heads, going over the ache of unhealed wounds, planning brilliant repartees, working on self-centered schemes, then when our friend slips, our hand reaches out to steady her. If a ball is overthrown, we catch it and toss it back, all without an intervening thought, nothing special. When the phone rings, we pick it up and say, "Hello?" This is life, the so-called point of practice. Living with less habitual, unconscious self-centeredness, we become more present. Being less here, we are more fully here than ever and can more appropriately act or not act as the situation requires. Great vows mature in the complex, imperfect mix of ordinary life. Yamada Roshi says that the point of practice is the maturing of character, which doesn't happen by willing ourselves into more mature versions of ourselves. It happens by losing ourselves. That is, losing sight of the self-consciousness that stands like a veil or wall between us and everything, even people we hold dear. Dropping the whole self-centered deal by focusing so fully on this moment of practice that the very concept of an isolated interior self fades or falls away, we touch base with the essential nature of all natures, human and non-human, the no nature, which is the key to our own missing humanity. But it is not a straightforward path marked by success after success. 7 times down, 8 times up, such is life, is how a Japanese folk saying puts it. The practice of climbing to the top of the mountain of Zen, we're told, isn't all that difficult. You work at it, keep at it, and in time, something. But then, when you start back down the mountain is when it hits you. The descending is endless. How does the Bodhisattva use all those hands and eyes? Is never ending. Stay with the practice. Stay with the breath. Stay with the koan. Ripeness, says Shakespeare, is all. We'll stop here and recite our great vows for all.